Ahead of this weekend's Mother's Day, today we celebrate not just mothers, but the act of mothering.
A really important message of the book is that this is really holy work. This matters. The ways we love as a mother just might be some of the ways that God keeps watch over us and loves us and is there for us.
Chicago writer Barbara Mahaney joins us to discuss her new book, Mother Prayer, Lessons in Loving. And we revisit our conversation with two Illinois hijab fashion bloggers.
The hijab for millions of women around the world is a decision that's very much personal and spiritual. But at the same time, if we have a big billion-dollar transnational Dolce & Gabbana coming by and making $700 hijabs for people, what does that mean?
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Mother's Day is coming up this Sunday, but maybe instead of that, we should celebrate Mothering Day. So says Barbara Mahaney, the former Chicago Tribune writer's new book called Mother Prayer, Lessons in Loving, is an exploration of love through the lens of motherhood. And she's with me now from Chicago. Barbara, welcome to the 21st. Thanks so much for being here with me.
Thank you for having me.
You know, in the introduction of the book, you pose the really big question that you answer throughout the book, which is, how truly do we love? And I wonder, when did you first start thinking about writing this book?
You know, I started writing the essays, I guess, from the time my first son was born. He's about to turn 24. I was a writer at the Tribune for almost 30 years, and my whole life I've been a writer, a kind of a closet writer, a hide under your bed writer. And so I've always been a person who writes down what's important, but specifically the essays that are in this book began in earnest about 10 years ago. I had been a feature writer for the Tribune, an investigative reporter for the Tribune, all kinds of things at the Tribune. And about the 25-year mark, I sat down with my editors and, you know, the yearly evaluation. They wanted to know what my goals were for the year. And I started talking about how I just had this deep sense that these really quiet stories that unfold on the home front could be held as much meaning, were as beautiful as, you know, the stories we trot out and write profiles of famous people and not so famous people. I'd always been a journalist who kind of kept my eye on the margins and was always fascinated exploring the depths of quiet people whom the world might not be paying attention to. So I had this idea and was riding home on the L that night thinking, gosh darn it, I don't know if I explained that to my editors very well. And it so happened that night, my then 13-year-old decided he would sit down and procrastinate with his homework and build me a website. So he built me a website and looked at me and said, Mom, you can do this, which he meant, Mom, you can blog. And as I've said before, when your 13-year-old looks you in the eyes and tells you you can do something, you get up the next morning before dawn and you start doing it. So I got up that next morning and I made a promise to myself, and it began as a writing practice that I've said became a spiritual practice. And what I did every morning was I would scan the landscape of the previous day, and I would look for that moment that just sort of held the most electricity, the most emotional zing, that begged to be mined, to be explored. And I would capture those moments. I would write about those moments. So for a year, I wrote every single weekday morning. And it was extraordinary that after all those years of writing front page newspaper stories and 10-part series for the newspaper, there was just something really profound that happened through that daily discipline. By sitting alone in the dark without an editor, without a safety net, hitting publish and like sending it out to the world, and everyone from my mother-in-law to people I didn't know could be reading it. So I started an everyday practice that after the first year, I cut back to 3 days a week and then 2 days a week, and I still write religiously once a week. So I had this collection. I have a collection of over 700 of these essays. And my first book, Slowing Time, Seeing the Sacred Outside Your Kitchen Door, was a collection of essays that just looked for the sacred in those quiet, sometimes noisy, messy moments that unfold all around in the home, in the garden, in the natural world, because those are places I see the sacred. And this book takes the focus tighter, and I look deeply at a mothering moments across the arc of those 10 years. And I've said, you know, some of them are, they're moments in the liminal space at the quiet edges of mothering, at the edges of mothering when you're utterly without an answer. And that's when I turn to prayer. Prayer for me is not scripted. It's just sort of free-flowing conversation, begging for help, begging for answers, whatever. So these essays are a collection that began when my older son was 13 in eighth grade, and my younger son was 5 and starting kindergarten, and they flow through about a year ago now. My older son has graduated from college and is on his way to law school, and my younger one is now a sophomore in high school.
Yeah.
So I'm able to capture some of those just sacred awakening moments of a little person learning to read, learning to, you know, all those.
Learning to pray.
And learning to pray.
Right, and I wanted to ask you about that, because so much of this book, as you're talking about, is about the sacred, is about your faith and your prayer. And I wonder why you think we have such a hard time defining what prayer is or talking about it.
I'm not sure why it seems to be a subject that's hard for a lot of people to get around. Maybe there are expectations that have come through the years, through churches and synagogues and prayer texts being handed to us and thinking we need to read these rote lines. I was blessed to grow up post-Vatican II. I was raised by these wild, wonderful Catholic nuns who quickly stripped off their habits and changed their names from, you know, their old-fashioned names to their birth names, I suppose. They were smoking behind the convent. And the God they introduced me to was one who was deeply intimate and ever-present. And so for me, prayer has just always been just an easy conversation, just an intimacy, a connectedness. I write in the book about, you know, just offering a consideration that in exploring the ways we love as a mother, just this always hearing the call of a child from down the hall in the dark of the night, always waiting up until you see the car lights come in the driveway, just a sense that in the ways we love our children just might be some of the ways that God keeps watch over us and loves us and is there for us. So my spirituality is subtle, I think, and it's deeply personal because I have this understanding of this tender, big-hearted God.
And, you know, I was thinking about that when I was reading this, because I don't know if you saw the Pope just gave this TED Talk.
I know that he gave it. Okay. I haven't had a chance to
so
hear it
he
yet.
Talked
I love
about,
him.
Yeah, well, it was so remarkable to me because he talked about tenderness. And I was thinking about it when I was reading your book, because he wrote, and this is, I was going to read it to you because I wasn't sure, and I'm not sure that everybody has seen the TED Talk that the Pope gave.
Right, not everybody tuned in the other day.
Perhaps not everyone saw that. But he said, what I thought was so interesting was he said that tenderness is the language of young children, of those who need the other. Mm. A child's love for mom and dad grows through their touch, their gaze, their voice, their tenderness. Mm. I like when I hear parents talk to their babies, adapting to the little child, sharing the same level of communication. This is tenderness, being on the same level as the other. And I wonder what your children, and you have sort of these moments throughout the of these essays, what your children taught you about tenderness.
Oh, Lord. Oh, there's one of the essays that I cry every time I read is one called Turning the Tables, something like that. It's about it's an essay about a few summers ago. I had this terrible, terrible high fever that just went on for almost a week. And my younger son, who was then maybe 10 or 11, had just had a terrible bike accident and had a broken arm. He was, you know, in a cast on his arm and a brace all the way up his leg. It's the second time one of my boys had a terrible bike accident, but they've both had terrible bike accidents. One broke his neck in a bike accident. But anyway, in this particular summer, so this darling boy is, you know, in a cast, in a leg brace, you know, limping up the stairs. I'm lying in bed with this high fever, and I start to hear these sounds from the kitchen, the sound of a metal bowl being taken taken out of the, you know, bowl closet. The sound of the ice, you know, ice chunks being clunked around in the ice tray. And then I start to hear this darling little limpy sound of him trying to come up the stairs with his one leg that can't bend. And I hear him go into the towel and washcloth closet and pull out a washcloth. And he comes in my room, and in this beautiful anointing that almost makes me cry to talk about now, he takes this ice cube in his washcloth and he starts to rub it in circles on my forehead.
Just like you used to do for him.
Yeah. And I said, honey, where did you learn? Who taught you this? Like, I was just astounded that this child was, you know, bathing me in cool waters. And he just quietly said, you. And I thought, oh, my God. Oh, my God. I have never been as tender as this child is being to me. I have. And so, you know, it's that consistent open-heartedness of these children. There's another essay about. His name is Teddy. I don't use his name in the essays in the book because part of my hope was to keep these essays sort of as open and easy for readers to slip their own stories and memories into. I wanted to kind
Right, so you don't really use their names that much.
No,
right.
But there's another story about, it's a silly little thing, but there are just so many deep eternal lessons tucked into these little things that unfold in the home front. It's a story about he forgot his darn spelling list when he was in third grade, and he had a spelling test the next day, and he, you know, kind of meekly comes to me and says, Mom, I forgot my spelling. And then I said, well, where could it be? And he's like, well, it could be in my desk, but my desk is pretty much of a mess, and I might not be able to find it. So, you know, we run off to the school in this dramatic thing to see if we can get the janitors to unlock the door and get to the spelling list, and we don't get to it. And so I'm sitting at my desk typing a note to the teacher saying, so sorry, this spelling test might be a bust tomorrow. And with that, this beautiful little note slides under the door. And I thought it was going to be Teddy's, you know, his best memory of what those spelling words could be. And
There were two words on there, right?
Yeah, the voice from the other side of the door is, you know, Mommy, did you see it? Mommy, please look. And I was, you know, sort of ignoring him, saying, just get to work on that list. And I finally look down at this piece of paper he slid under the door, and it just says, so sorry, I will make you coffee and breakfast tomorrow. Or I will make you coffee and breakfast. I don't have the book opened, so I can't read the exact words. But it was something like that. I happened to write that essay on the brink of Yom Kippur. And I had just been, we're a Jewish Catholic family. I was raised Catholic. My husband, Blair Kamen, who's the Tribune's longtime architecture critic, is an observant Jew. And we raised our boys both Jewish and Catholic, which has made religion an interesting topic in our family. And I had been talking just that very day to a beloved rabbi of ours, and she was talking about teshuvah and how it's repent and repair. And I was so taken that this little guy went straight to I'm sorry and straight to repair.
Yeah,
Right. I'll make you breakfast and coffee. So
I think it's misspelled too, the way that he spells breakfast and coffee. Of course.
So he didn't do so good on that spelling test, but I'll never forget those beautiful words.
Well, and I think, you know, there's an essay about how much as a parent, the moments you treasure are your conversations, listening to them at the kitchen table. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that's a large part of the intention of this, isn't it? Did you find in your daily practice that you approached parenthood differently because you were recording these moments?
I don't think so. I mean, there was sort of a seamlessness between the writing was something I did each morning. It was it became a sacred practice. The mothering is just who I am and what I do full throttle. And the listening was always probably the part of mothering I'm most enchanted, one of the parts of mothering I'm most enchanted by. You know, I've said, you know, I've been a student of the human heart my whole life. I was a pediatric oncology nurse before I was a journalist, before I was a mom. And when I was in nursing school, I went to this fabulous Jesuit nursing school, and we had a whole semester course in listening, believe it or not. It was one of the first core courses in the nursing curriculum, and it was taught by a brilliant professor. And we spent a semester considering the art of listening. And as someone who's ever been enchanted and intrigued and fascinated by the human heart, listening is my landscape. You know, whether I was a nurse at Children's Memorial in Chicago taking care of kids who were dying of cancer or suffering, you know, lifelong chronic incurable diseases, or a reporter at the Tribune, you know, traipsing all around Chicagoland and around the country for various assignments, what's drawn me to everything I do is sitting down and exploring someone else's heart and landscape and the way they view the world. So doing it with my children was just a natural, even deeper extension of that. And I think that's why mothering has so deeply captured my imagination. And it's why I decided putting all those journalistic and nursing skills to these simple stories, profound stories that unfold on the home front, were a way of me, a really important message of the story of the book is to say to other mothers and those who mother, we can talk about that in a little bit, is that this is really holy work. This matters. The most important work of my life is mothering these children.
We need to take a break, but when we come back, we are going to continue this conversation with Barbara Mahaney. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Barbara Mahaney. She's a former Chicago Tribune writer and columnist. Her latest book is called Mother Prayer, Lessons in Loving. Ahead of Mother's Day this Sunday, we're talking to her about that. And it is, you were just saying just before we took a break that that the whole notion of motherhood versus mothering is something that's really important to you to make a distinction about, right?
Absolutely.
Why
Absolutely.
Is that?
It's because I it's the verb mothering that I think is so important, and that the act of mothering love, the act of tender caring, leaving mercy in your wake, is something that belongs to anybody, whether you've birthed a child or adopted a child, or simply, you know, been that person on the block who opens your door and lets in, you know, the kid who needs someone to talk to. As I write in one of the, you know, beginning essays in the book, it's not necessarily even only women who are motherers. I know men, for heaven's sake, who mother and mother beautifully. And as someone who struggled through the years with, you know, the heartbreak of miscarriage and infertility and just about every complication along that road you could think of, I know full well how painful Mother's Day can be for women who ache to become mothers and for whom it's just, you know, the biology isn't working. And so my life is filled with, you know, dear friends of mine who chose not to have children. And they're, you know, some of my boys' best aunties. And, you know, they take them on outings. They let the boys confide in them. So it just was really important to me. I'm ecumenical from the beginning to the end. And I don't want, I'm always about opening doors and inviting in and, you know, to claim that we're only celebrating mothers who
on were, one Sunday, which yeah. I was going to say, you're actually yeah. speaking at Old St. Pat's this Sunday, right?
I love this. The Mother's Mass at Old St. Pat's is always the Tuesday or Wednesday after Mother's Day, because they know that mothers are obligated on Mother's Day. So they give them a little time out after Mother's
Day.
I
see. But, you know, I know that you say you resist the urge also that we just set aside one Sunday for all of this also.
Exactly. So, you know, one of the hopes of the book is that by, you know, shining a light on just these quotidian mysteries of mothering, just the quiet, crazy things that can unfold in a day, that mothers, you know, get the message that what they're doing really really matters. And this is holy work. And, you know, raising these little people from the time someone first puts them in your arms until, you know, you wave goodbye, you know, when they're long gone, you know, after college graduation and they come home for the occasional visit, you know, mothering goes on forever. But it's important work. And the lessons we teach our children are perhaps the most indelible lessons we can leave behind in this world.
You mentioned this. You mentioned there is a lot of joy and there's a lot of heartbreak in these mm-hmm. essays. And there's mm-hmm. a couple passages where you do talk about your struggles, the little girl that you lost to miscarriage. Mm-hmm. I'm so sorry for that loss.
Thank you.
When did you decide to write about that and your grief? Because I also know that you write later about a sisterhood that you think develops among women who've gone through this, and you describe it as sort of the light and darkness mm-hmm. of fertility.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think I actually wrote that the essay you're referring to, it's called Tea for Two. And I wrote that before I wrote many of the rest of the essays. So I had, I was blessedly pregnant a third time. My first pregnancy was an ectopic pregnancy that ended in emergency surgery, and was heartbreaking to be a first-time pregnant person whose pregnancy, you know, ends in total loss. My second pregnancy was a beautiful full-term Will. And then about 18 months after Willie was born, I found out I was pregnant again. And I, you know, we had seen there's nothing more beautiful than seeing the beating heart in an ultrasound. And because I was an older mother, I always had early ultrasounds.
And also a former nurse, right?
And also a former nurse. So seeing that little dot blinking on the ultrasound screen and hearing the sound of the heart beating at like 6 weeks just takes my breath away. So, you know, we had seen the heart. We knew I was about 14 weeks pregnant. And, you know, without going into details, you know, that was my sweet baby girl who died in the womb. She had trisomy. She was a trisomy 13 baby, which is a congenital anomaly that's not almost never compatible with life beyond, you know, maybe a baby would live for a couple of months, but then they wouldn't live. So she died in the womb and I miscarried her, and it was heartbreaking, so heartbreaking. And then finding out she was my little girl was just, you know, I was I grew up with four brothers and no sisters, and my firstborn was a boy, and I, you know, thought a girl would be just delicious. And so I went to Little Street Studios. They were offering a class to make a miniature tea set, and it just felt so perfect to sort of go away for a Sunday afternoon and sit down and work with clay and work through my grief in some way and walk out with a tangible miniature object, something that was so iconic to me, a totem perhaps of mother and daughterhood, only one aspect of it, of course, but it was a sweet, dear thing. So I wrote the essay shortly after I had spent that Sunday afternoon at the pottery wheel. I often write, you know, when my heart is bursting. I've just been one of those people who, when my heart is bursting, I grab a pen. So I wrote that essay shortly after that. And so that's where that essay came from. And then, you know, the 8 years between Will and Teddy were punctuated with heartbreak and loss and, you know, that heart-wrenching cycle of, you know, every month you get your hopes up for, you know, two hopeful weeks, and they come dashing, crashing when you find out, you know, you're not pregnant. So I just have such deep empathy, and women who've suffered infertility and miscarriage tend to quietly find each other. I guess I just turn up my antenna and listen closely, the checker at my grocery store was someone I had lots of conversations about this with because I knew how deeply she wanted to get pregnant. And we just sort of find each other. And so that sisterhood of the dark and light of fertility is one that's really palpable, and it never ends. I am forever empathetic and conscious of how hard it can be.
I'm speaking with Barbara Mahaney. We're talking to her about her latest book. She's on the line from Chicago. Her book is called Mother Prayer, Lessons in Loving. And how your oldest son, is he, you said he's 24 now?
He's about to turn 24.
Okay, so what does he think about you writing about his five-year-old monster fighting outfits that he used to wear to bed?
Well, the monster fighter is the little one.
Oh, he's the little one. Okay.
The little one.
How old is he now?
He's 15 now.
So he really loves that you're writing
about
him. Yeah,
he's like, oh, great mom. Actually, it was really sweet. When the book came, when I got my first copy about a month or so ago, my husband was out of town for a couple of days, and Teddy wasn't ready to go to sleep. So he decided he said, can we read? And I was like, sure, we can read. So he grabbed the book and started reading some of the essays. And the sweetest thing in the world was he read the one essay aloud, the last one that I wrote about his older brother choosing to come home between college and law school. His older brother, Will, called me right before Christmas of his senior year of college and said, Mom, I want to do something really meaningful between college and law school, and I can't think of anything more meaningful than coming home to be with Ted. And so he came home, and he lived with us for a year while he was teaching on the west side of Chicago and working an unpaid internship at the Cook County Public Defender's Office. And during that year, my husband's father died. Two dear, close friends of ours died. Our cat died. It was a really hard year, and it was a beautiful year for these two boys who, were born 8 years apart and kind of in their own orbits for the first, for the beginnings of Teddy's life, certainly, and are now just deeply, deeply close and call each other's best friend. So when Teddy read
despite the 8 year difference, right?
Yeah, the 8 year difference. When Teddy was reading that essay, he just started crying. And I don't think the boys will read a lot of the essays now, but I have said that a deeply palpable reason for me writing these and wanting them to be in a book is so that my boys would forever have a record of how deeply and exquisitely they were loved. As someone, my father died, he just dropped dead suddenly when he was 52, and he had been a writer and an ad man, but I had no writings I could find of his. And I think, that emptiness, that hollowness, that my dad was a word man and I don't have any letters he wrote to me, was something that maybe propelled my wanting to leave this stack of love letters to my boys. I'm fully aware that why would the boys care to read what their mom writes now? But there will someday be a day, maybe when I'm no longer here, when picking up this book and sifting through and remembering these moments, recapturing these moments, will mean something to them.
Well, and also maybe cooking, because one thing we haven't talked about is the recipes that you have in here. And I have to say, I've never perfected the art of oatmeal.
Oh.
Or as you write, as my British, I have a British side of the family, they also say porridge.
Porridge.
And you have all of these recipes sprinkled throughout the book, macaroni and cheese, brisket. And I wonder for you, I know this is like this for my mom, how much of your cooking for others is an expression of love?
It's an expression of love. And as I say, I talk about the incantations of the cook stove. It's prayerfulness. When you're standing there on a cold winter morning, stirring your porridge, and throwing in, handfuls of cranberries or chopped up dried apricots or raisins or whatever you're throwing in at these amulets of motherhood, you're stoking your child for the day. And there are so many places and moments in mothering and in prayer where we kind of run out of words. We run out of ways to as fully envelop the human heart as we wish we could. So sometimes, you know, we're left to putting a bowl of steaming hot, delicious porridge in front of your, you know, in front of their little hungry mouths in the morning. And that's, that might be the best prayer we can give them for the day. And so the recipes just sort of naturally wove their way into the book. There were recipes in my first book and people seemed to enjoy those. And I get a huge kick out of hearing people come up to me, you know, people I don't know. And from the first book, they'll say, oh, I made that cranberry pear relish from Aunt Brooke. And, you know, it's just so interesting as books come to life. And so the recipes in this book, my boys will never be able to say, Mom, I can't find that macaroni and cheese recipe you always made for my birthday, because now it's in a book. And so with the brisket and my mom's hilarious dish from the Peg Bracken, what's the title of the Peg Bracken book? I can't remember the Peg Bracken book that I refer to in the essay about my mom's chicken rice Grammy. There's this hilarious book that came out in the 70s about I think it's called the I Hate to Cook book. Okay. So anyway, all the family treasures are there.
Yeah. Did you have a hard time picking which recipes you were going to put in there?
I mean,
I like that they're interfaith, that you have macaroni and cheese and you have brisket and you have the recipe for how to make brisket kosher, too.
Indeed, I do. As I say in the book, you know, since I might have one of the few, I hope my mother-in-law, God bless her, I love her to pieces, but she is a renowned non-Jewish cook. So I don't have like the classic, you know, Jewish mother-in-law like leaning over my shoulder telling me how to make the brisket and the this and the that. So I have all these wonderful adopted Jewish mothers, from Ina Pinckney, who told, you know, from the great Ina's, she's had a couple restaurants here in Chicago that are just huge, had always been hugely popular.
It's kind of funny. I think they say that Sunday, Mother's Day, is like the busiest day for eating out for the year, right? It's like
one
of the busiest because it's the one day that mothers are not cooking. So.
Yeah, but good luck getting a reservation, people.
Exactly. So thank you so much for sharing with us, for speaking with us. Barbara Mahaney, her latest book is called Mother Prayer, Lessons in Loving. She's based in Chicago still, longtime former Chicago Tribune feature writer, journalist, columnist. Thank you for being with me, Barbara. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I love talking to you.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to revisit our conversation with two Illinois hijab fashion bloggers. Stay tuned for that. As a reminder, you can always send us your feedback on social media. We'd love to hear from you. You can follow us on Facebook, search for The 21st to like us. You can post comments or ask us questions that you'd like us to ask on air. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle's 21stshow, that's 21st show. Follow us during the program. We tweet out background and analysis about what we're talking about. Oftentimes, there are a lot of things that we use to prepare for the show. So follow us for that. And when we're not on the air, we're tweeting out the latest in Illinois news. Again, our handle's 21st show. Stay tuned. We'll be continuing the program just after this short break. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Earlier this year, Nike announced it's rolling out a line of hijabs for women athletes, the first for a major sports brand, that follows fashion houses like Dolce & Gabbana, debuting hijab and abayas in its 2016 line. Somali-American model Halima Aden, who wears the hijab, was recently signed by IMG Models. It's a lucrative market. Muslim shoppers spent almost $250 billion on clothes. That was back in 2015. Today, we wanted to revisit a conversation with two Muslim fashion bloggers based in Chicago, Hoda Khatabi and Miriam Sob. Hoda, Miriam, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks so much, Kyla.
Let's start, Hoda, with you. I wonder, just to get your reaction, and Miriam, if you could weigh in after, about the Nike announcement yesterday saying it's a huge step forward, other people saying I'd never wear a hijab with a swoosh on it and that they already work out with headscarves. What are you guys hearing about yesterday's announcement, Hoda?
Yeah, for sure. So I think right off the bat, representation is definitely integral for oppressed and marginalized communities. I think it's great that this image of a hijab-wearing Muslim woman is starting to become normalized within media and fashion. But at the same time, if they are actually doing this for Muslim women, why don't they start with their sweatshops that actually exploit Muslim women? A lot of these big companies like Dolce & Gabbana and Nike are kind of playing lip service, and just kind of using this image of the hijab as a way of, tapping into a $1 billion market, as you mentioned yourself, and also just kind of at this political climate right now with everything that's happening, the increase of anti-Muslim racism at federal and local levels, what does it mean for a huge $1 billion company to come out and have an image of a hijab-wearing woman, yet nothing actually substantially happening within their factories, within where Muslim women are being affected the most by their practices.
Right, and I should mention, Hoda, your blog, it's Juju Azad, is that correct?
Yes.
And you talk not just about fashion, but activism. Miriam, what about you? Your blog, Hijab Trends, what's sort of your reaction to yesterday's Nike announcement?
Well, it's interesting because I'm actually writing up a post about this. So I think it's two different things. On one hand, it's exciting. It's refreshing to see. I mean, I have two young daughters, so it's like, okay, you can see your identity out there and it's normal, as Hoda mentioned. The only other part that is a little bit, maybe it's kind of annoying for people in the Muslim community, is like, we've had companies that have been putting out, let's say, like sports hijabs. There's a woman in the Netherlands who came up with Capsters. She's not a Muslim woman, but she came up with a solution over a decade ago because they weren't allowing Muslim women to play sports in the Netherlands with hijabs. So it's kind of interesting how, like, when a big company comes in, it's all the rage, it's everywhere, but you kind of forget about the smaller companies that have been there. That being said, though, I can't say that I wouldn't like to go running with a Nike swoosh, because then I feel like I'm part of the crowd.
Yeah, right. It's sort of two sides of this, right? Hoda, let me ask you, on a blog, I was reading part of your blog, and you were saying you get pitched by brands all the time, and how much that pitch has changed in the past year and a half. Because a couple years ago, you were getting pitched from people saying how much they appreciate your work, and they, you know, believe you have similar values and visions, and they want to collaborate, to now it's sort of being a conversation in the past year about how Muslims are trending in the media, and this is like a trendy thing. Maybe there's a little kind of cultural appropriation going on there. Is that, it's sort of your sense of how you feel like things have changed in the past year?
Largely, yes. So, I mean, this fascination, this Western fascination with the hijab has always existed, so it's not necessarily new. It's the reason why the United States decided to go into Afghanistan, you know, to save the backwards hijabi woman from a savage brown man. So it's always been used, you know, a hijab-wearing woman has always been used by the West, whether it's for political occupation and war, or if it's for kind of tapping into a $1 billion company. And so, yeah, as someone who gets pitched by brands to collaborate all the time, as you mentioned, I've seen pitches start from really valuing my work and my focus on ethical fashion and my vision. And now it's kind of like, oh, I see your identity and I want to tokenize you. I want to include your image in my social media so then I can tap into your market. But I can also say that now I'm progressive and now I'm rebellious because I'm lifting up the voices of marginalized communities. But
Yeah, and it sounds like, and that makes a lot of sense. I wondered, to Miriam's point, is there also the tension there of saying, like, there's all of that, but then there's also sort of a, I don't want to use the word mainstream, but I wonder if it's just sort of a more of a seeing this out in the general population and helping sort of be more affirming for young Muslim women, for, as Miriam was talking about, her daughters. Is that part of the tension of this also?
Mm-hmm. I would say yes, except I've seen what a good pitch looks like, and I've seen what good intentions from brands look like.
Sure.
Before, like, refugees were trending, and this Muslim identity is now the next hottest trend that everyone wants to claim or, like, wave above their head. So I've seen what brands can actually do when they want to work on representation and want to increase their support of Muslim women. Usually they'll at least compensate someone who they want to use their identity. You know, it's not just kind of very much lip service. If you're going to be supporting Muslim women, and I also only work with ethical brands, meaning that I don't want to work with brands that are actually exploiting women, mostly Muslim women in the back end. And so if I want a brand to come out and support me as a Muslim woman, I prefer that they start with their sweatshop factories.
Sure. That's that obviously makes a lot of sense. Miriam, can I ask you about, we mentioned at the beginning of this, Dolce & Gabbana launching in 2016, launching Hijab Abaya's line. Of course, featuring, and then they're featuring models who maybe not necessarily, or, you know, this is always a question about diversity and representation, whether we're talking about modeling or other fields. And I wanted to ask you about Somali American model Halima Aden, and she does wear hijab, and she was recently signed by IMG. How significant do you think that is for the fashion industry?
I think it's one of two things. I mean, it could be very significant, but I fear that it's just a trend. And as Hoda mentioned, it's just the new in thing that everybody wants to be part of. And so she's something different. You know, will they be, you know, are we going to suddenly see like 10 other Muslim girls get signed to the modeling agency? I highly doubt it. I think she's going to be like that anomaly that they're going to use for a couple of years if she's lucky.
Yeah. Well, and I'm thinking about people like Gigi Hadid, right? She's half Palestinian, mm-hmm. Chosen to be the first cover model of Vogue Arabia, which is launching in the Middle East next month. And I know she doesn't normally wear hijab, but she did for this shoot. And I wonder you guys, is your thoughts on that. Miriam, you want to start?
I think it's so bizarre to me. I mean, why did she have to wear the hijab on the cover of the magazine when not a lot of women have to wear it, right? So, or choose to wear it. So that didn't make sense to me. Like, why would they choose this exotic cover for Vogue Arabia? It's not Vogue Hijab, it's Vogue Arabia. So if you go to the Gulf and the Middle East, you will see tons of women who don't wear the hijab, who are into fashion. And I feel like that magazine probably speaks to that market more than it does to women who wear hijab. So I just feel like it's like, maybe they were trying to like affirm her identity and be like, yeah, she is half Muslim. So I don't know. I mean, I still can't even wrap my head around that.
Yeah, Hoda, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree a lot with everything that Miriam is saying, because it, the way that it also, the photos were taken, and yes, the editor-in-chief is actually someone who's a Middle Eastern herself, a literal princess, actually. But that doesn't mean that she can't fall victim to portraying and depicting Muslim women in this white, imperialist, and Orientalist gaze. This kind of hijab, again, as it could be oppressive, could be also sexual and eroticized. So that's kind of where that sat with me, and it was very unsettling. And I don't want to call out Gigi Hadid for like being excited to be on the cover. Like I want to be able to support people, but I also want to at the same time make sure that people are responsible with what images they're creating, and kind of the editorial direction behind this, and like who was this image created for? Is it created for Muslim hijabi women? Because Muslim hijabi women usually don't wear hijabs that are embezzled, I mean, covered in gemstones and without usually a shirt on. So, but if it's created for people who aren't hijabi women, why was that image created? You know, so a lot of kind of thinking about the intentions behind these images.
Well, and it might have also been just designed to be controversial, so we would all talk about it like we are right now, too, right? Because it might have just been also very smart marketing. You know, just to talk about the fashion itself, I'm thinking about brands like Uniqlo collaborating with Muslim designer Hana Tajima to create a collection that includes headscarves, longer tops, flowing pants. Miriam, do you think companies are beginning to realize, and it's kind of just also sort of part of the fashion we're seeing this year, like lots of flowy things, like the bohemian look mm-hmm. is kind of in. I don't know if companies are beginning. Do you think companies are thinking about modesty and fashion aren't being mutually exclusive, or it's just sort of the look right now?
I think it could be the look. And I think maybe more women are realizing, like, why do I have to show every single body part to people? You know, I choose what I want to show when I want to show it. And sometimes there, I mean, in the past, there weren't many options. But I have to say that I do applaud Uniqlo for working with Hana Tajima, because they actually worked with a Muslim designer. And I've interviewed her in the past, and she's someone that I find to be very genuine and focused on ethical fashion, someone that really, you know, teamed up with them with the right idea behind it, I believe. Whereas you have Dolce & Gabbana, where it's like they're designing $5,000 and up abayas that nobody can afford.
Right. The 5,000. Yeah. let me just end by asking both of you, Hoda, you know, as we've talked about this, I mean, where do you see hijab fashion headed from here? Are you seeing this? I'm curious what you're sort of seeing, what you're looking forward to in the next couple of months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm definitely happy that more Muslim women are stepping up and taking space, whether that's in modeling, in fashion, in media and communications. And I think this is very, very important. I think representation is vital. And so I am definitely excited to see this coming from Muslim women And at the same time, though, I'm worried that trends, like you mentioned, this whole thing about loose clothing and modesty is going to become a new trend without giving credit where credit is due. And we see that happening a lot, especially within the fashion industry. They'll take a trend, say dreadlocks on the Marc Jacobs runway, and say that he was avant-garde and, you know, so rebellious, whereas Black people in this country have to fight to keep their dreadlocks at the workplace, you know. So not giving credit where people have been kind of already taking leadership and ownership of all of these styles, and then making it seem like it's a new thing. Like, for example, even thick eyebrows, you know. Cara Delevingne, who's the top model, is cited as bringing thick eyebrows back, whereas I was made fun of for my thick eyebrows as a middle schooler.
Yeah, I think so. We all were. I can definitely, right. Miriam, can I ask you just about, when we think about all of the blogs and social media accounts, I mean, how much that's also sort of playing a role in this of everybody? There's so many people. I'm thinking about, you began Hijab Trends in 2007, and it wasn't like, you know, there weren't like all of these online tutorials and Instagram and things like that. Do you think that's played a role in all of this changing too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have now Muslim bloggers who are getting signed up to major agencies and advertising things like yogurt, random stuff, because they have such a big audience, and people are tapping in to the Muslim market because it's, you know, people are highly educated and they have a lot of disposable income. And, you know, the markets that they've been trying to target are just not relevant anymore. So this is the new thing.
Where do you think everything's going from here? What are you most excited about, Miriam?
For me, I mean, as much as we can rant or go negative on some of this stuff, I think for me, the positive thing is seeing more representation, and hopefully it'll trickle down in a way where it's just normal. And, you know, we'll see a Muslim woman in a headscarf portraying herself in a TV show, and it's not a terrorist.
Thanks for that. That's Miriam Sob. She blogs at Hijab Trends. I want to also thank Hoda Kotabi. Her blog is Juju Azad. Did I say that? Juju Azad.
Juju Azad, yes.
Juju Azad. Thanks so much, ladies. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. Coming up next week, we're going to explore what impact the opioid crisis has had on communities throughout Illinois. Plus, we speak with the person who's arguably the world's coolest scientist, Neil deGrasse Tyson, about his new book, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry.
Often you think of books are written about what we know. There's a lot we don't know, and there's chapters in there about stuff we don't know. And that's part of the mystery of the universe and what drives us to wake up each morning and run to the lab or run to the rocket launch pad and track the data of our telescopes and our space probes and our computer simulations and all of the exchanged ideas that goes on in workshops and conferences.
That's astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. Don't miss our conversation with him about his new book. That's coming up on Monday. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. And if you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, figure out how to follow us on social media, it's all on our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Christine Herman and Alan Montecelio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. We say goodbye to our intern, Abrar Alhiti, today. This is her last day. We wish her best of luck in the next steps for her career. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.